Martin Scorsese's film Gangs of New York is set in the mid-1800s and tells the story of fighting between Irish Catholic immigrants and the established Protestant gangs in the city.
In the second year of the Great Civil War, when the Irish Brigade marched through the streets, New York was a city full of tribes. When the Irish came, the city was in a fever. Since the time of the Great Famine, they'd come streaming off the boats. And they got a right warm welcome.
Go back to Ireland, you dumb mate!
You remember that, you frog Irish!
He's making the food, Paddy!
In fact, the Protestant community in New York City and elsewhere picked up destitute Irish Catholic children off the streets and sent them away on what came to be known as orphan trains to be raised by Protestant families out west. Up to 1 million Irish Catholic children were taken in this way, and most would never see their parents again. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later on today's show, Americans wringing their hands over the influx of Latino workers can find historical precedent in Prussia over a century ago.
Prussia in the 1880s was in some ways just like the U.S. now. It had great big sort of factory farms, and it was importing lots of Poles as sort of cheap migrant labor. But that resulted in a hue and cry in Prussia about the Polonization of Prussia, just like we talk about the Latinization of the United States.
But first, it was Irish Catholic nuns that eventually put a stop to the orphan trains, and it was their determined efforts to keep the poor Catholic children with their own parents that became the foundation for America's welfare system and foster care. Maureen Fitzgerald is a professor of American Studies at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. She's the author of Habits of Compassion, Irish Catholic Nuns and the Origins of the Welfare State. So where did the story begin of the Irish nuns in America that eventually formed the foundation for our welfare system?
It begins in Ireland, where a very small number of women were nuns, but they were part of the famine migration. About 1 million people starved to death. Another 2 million moved to North America. Ireland's population was cut in about half. Some of them came often through chain migration, where families would contribute collectively to send one migrant over. If that first link in the chain was somehow broken, the people on the other side in Ireland risked being sent away from their homes or starving to death.
How were the Irish communities perceived at that time?
When the Irish came, they were not only Catholic, but they were very poor. And so the kinds of prejudice they faced combined that Catholicism and that poverty in a very specific kind of way.
So what did the Protestants do about these poor Catholic paupers as they saw them?
Well, they tried to do a lot of things with adults, and adults were not very amenable to being reformed. So what they did is they moved to children. The kids who were on the streets in New York or Boston or Philly or all the Eastern Seaboard, they were on the street during school hours. A Protestant mission could pick them up. If the parents did not find them within 24 to 48 hours, that Protestant mission could have legal authority over them for the length of that child's minority. 1 million kids were taken in this way.
I'm trying to imagine how huge an impact that would have been. Weren't parents up in arms over having their children wrenched from them in this way?
Oh, of course. They were absolutely devastated. And many of them were Irish speakers or Gaelic speakers only. They were not English speakers. They went to their churches. They asked for help. They did what they could. But the mission really tried very hard to make sure that the parents would not have any contact with the children. Because what they did is they didn't just keep them in the mission in the city. They put them on trains and they sent them to the Midwest to live within Protestant families for the length of their minority. And again, keeping that information absolutely from their parents of origin. Because the point was to break up the family. The point was not to reproduce this Irish Catholic system that the mainstream believed was going to actually reproduce poverty.
They thought, like so many people think today, of the stubbornly poor, that it was somehow their fault.
It was clearly parents' fault, because if they were adults and they were living in poverty, they must have done something to get there. But kids didn't need to suffer for the sins, this is their language, of their parents. And so they were willing, and they thought they were being very benevolent, to take those kids out of those situations and put them in a better place.
So what did become of up to a million children who were part of these orphan trains between 1850s and 1900?
You can see a range in anecdotal evidence from people who, I think there's a governor of Michigan who was a kid who was placed with a family. That family was very devoted to him. He was very much brought up as an adopted son, and he eventually becomes governor of Michigan. So he saw that as a very positive experience. There are lots of other kids who run away from these situations. There was certainly danger for boys, or especially young girls, who were not young enough to be really integrated into the family, but used either as farm labor and having their labor exploited, or for young girls being sexually exploited. And so we do see a lot of concern by the 1870s in states throughout the Midwest that essentially what these Protestant missions are doing are dumping these kids, and they're not overseeing how the family is treating them. Those kids then end up being on the streets of places like Detroit and Chicago, because they then have to make it on their own somehow in the Midwest. There's occasionally a story where a parent will actually find a child who had been brought up in another family, but it's very rare.
So when did the Irish Catholic nuns come into the picture?
Well, they come in very quickly. The first work that the nuns I look at in New York did was to work with single women. Sisters of Mercy, for instance, they are most known for bringing in 20,000 of these single Irish females and putting them into domestic service positions. They would also, because the nuns were probably the only literate people in this population, they'd write letters back home, they'd send the money home, and so essentially the nuns themselves were links in that chain. Once the immediacy of the famine had passed, the focus really shifted from single women to children and the idea that they had to stop what was going on with what they called the kidnapping of these children. And so they began, in many senses, to expand their convents simply to take in kids. In some cases, if they had set up schools, they would put beds in the schools' rooms, with the idea that if a child was in any way susceptible to being picked up, a parent could bring that child to the nuns, keep them with the nuns, and they would not then be vulnerable to the Protestant missions. They expanded this tremendously once the Irish had power in City Hall to start funneling lots of money to the nuns, so that, you know, what might have been a small convent that would be a three-story building in Washington Square became an enormous institution that could house anywhere from 800 to 1,200 kids.
Really?
Yeah, they were enormous. And at the height of this in New York, I believe they had 15,000 children in institutions at any one time. Parents would put the kids in when they thought they were close enough to poverty to warrant the kids at least getting three meals a day and some schooling. But parents always had the right to take kids out when and if they wanted to. What these nuns wanted to do was to make those ties with parents as absolutely strong as possible. They also, of course, wanted to reproduce Irish Catholicism. And there's no doubt about that. These kids were going to learn the basics of catechism and everything else the nuns wanted to teach them, as well as the basics of public school. And to give you a statistic on nuns, there were 500 of them in all of the United States in 1850. There were 50,000 of them in 1900, and about 4,000, 3 to 4,000 in New York City alone. So they come from working class backgrounds. They have a critique, certainly, of the Protestant reformers. But they also have a critique of how Protestants are treating the poor. There is within Catholicism a less sense of shame in being poor. And if you can imagine that Catholicism developed in the medieval period where class hierarchies were static, they were not dynamic. You were not poor because you had a moral failing. You were poor because you were born a serf. There wasn't anything to punish you about. You were not rich because you were terrific morally. You were rich because you were born that way. You were born into that lineage. So that's the economic system that Catholicism comes from. And importantly, Judaism also had a very similar critique of the way the Protestants treated the poor. Judaism presumes they'll be poor. There will be poor people, and there are many injunctions for Jews to take care of the poor, and especially not to take credit for taking care of the poor, but just to presume they're there and presume that if you're lucky enough to have something to give to someone, that you should.
So what eventually happened with this system where the nuns were taking in the Catholic children to keep them from being bussed out west? Did that system work beautifully?
Absolutely not, because even if the nuns were down the street, those nuns now were taking mothering and parenting responsibilities from those parents. And so those parents lost control of their kids for a short time rather than for eternity. But nonetheless, it was a very painful decision for a lot of poor people to make. They often made it thinking that if, you know, they had a good break here or they were lucky there, they could bring the kids back. But it often took them much longer to get the kids back or to get the right apartment so that they felt they could take the kids back.
Well, how do you see that these institutions became part of the underpinnings for the welfare system then?
Well, what was critical is that the premise that the state had an obligation to care for poor children and that parents should not necessarily lose all legal rights to their children because they were in poverty. The two parts of the welfare state we still live with today, and they're both terribly imperfect, is that the state pays mothers, especially, to care for children if the state deems those mothers good mothers. If the state deems those mothers bad mothers, it will pay another mother to rear that child. But it won't be in a Catholic institution. It'll likely be within an individual home.
It's really amazing to me. The parallel seems so strong between how mainstream Americans viewed the wretchedly poor Irish at the turn of the 20th century and how mainstream America now sees poor African American community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's interesting to me is that there's a language called the culture of poverty that often gets used when talking about African Americans. And African Americans at the time that the Irish came during the famine were in slavery. And so no one was in any way hassling them because they were poor. They were supposed to be poor. They were slaves. The Irish were the group that were the origins of this kind of harassment because of presumably their culture of poverty. And it's only later that African Americans, in being integrated into capitalism, start getting tagged as poor because of their cultural or moral inferiority, rather than because of their status as slaves, for instance. So yes, we do. We constantly use this, and we use it for new immigrant groups. And once those immigrant groups get assimilated and they get to middle-class status, they'll use it against other immigrant groups. Our capacity to see poverty over and over again as a moral and a cultural failing rather than a systemic condition of capitalism, I think, is inexhaustible. I always ask my students, okay, imagine this scenario. There are three of you walking down the street of a major city. One of you pulls out money when they see a homeless person. Another of the two says, don't give them money. And then I ask them, what does that person say? And verbatim, they will all tell me the same thing. If you give them money, they will go drink or use drugs. You're saying that there's a causation of poverty that's moral. It's not that this poor guy just broke his arm and can't pay the rent and now he's on the sidewalk. It's that either drugs or drinking led him to this position. And the second part of that is that if we help them, it will exacerbate the problem instead of making it better for them. By giving money, we make it worse. It tells me that we are devoted in a profound way to seeing poverty as a moral and a cultural issue rather than a systemic problem.
All the sisters of mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song. Oh, I hope you run into them, you who've been traveling so long.
Maureen Fitzgerald is a professor of American Studies at the College of William & Mary and the author of Habits of Compassion, Irish Catholic Nuns, and the Origins of the Welfare State. Coming up next, some perspective on America's guest worker program. Americans hold conflicting views on the vast numbers of unauthorized foreign workers in the labor force. But we've been in this situation many times before. Our next guest, Cindy Hahamovich of the College of William & Mary, is an expert on America's guest worker program.
Well, as the name suggests, guest workers are guests of the state. They are people who come on a temporary basis with a visa that allows them to work in the United States. They are today a tiny fraction of the U.S. labor force.
The U.S. has always imported vast quantities of foreign labor, whether it started with slaves or indentured servants or people coming across the border. We've relied on this for the kind of economy we have.
Yeah, there's nothing new about international labor migration. As soon as there were borders, people crossed those borders. Right now, there are some 200 million labor migrants around the globe. And if you add to them the families, the people that depend on the remittances that they send back, you've got about 500 million people.
How many in America?
We've got a couple hundred thousand guest workers. We have, as you know, perhaps 11 million unauthorized migrants in the U.S. Now, there are, of course, proposals to, in the last few years, there have been a number of proposals to deal with the issue of unauthorized migration in the U.S. by transforming those people into guest workers.
Because you study the guest worker program, I think you have a little bit more global insight into how American firms use cheap labor. Where do you think the guest worker program belongs as the rest of us are feeling confused about illegal immigration and whether this is new and what we should do about it?
Yeah. It's a question that I began pondering a while ago when I was trying to figure out the origins of these things. And I found the first ones in South Africa and Prussia in the 1880s. Prussia in the 1880s was in some ways just like the U.S. now. It had great big sort of factory farms. And it was importing lots of Poles as sort of cheap migrant labor. But that resulted in a hue and cry in Prussia about the Polonization of Prussia, just like we talk about the Latinization of the United States, right? Too many Poles. Well, the result was the deportation of some 40,000 Poles in the mid-1880s. And that left these big plantation owners in a lurch. What were they going to do without the Poles? And it resulted in a compromise in 1890. They could have the Poles back as long as they came under certain terms, and these were the terms. Only men could come, no women. The problem with women is they reproduce. They had to have ID cards that identified them as Polish. They were not allowed to speak German, and they couldn't hold meetings in Polish. And they had to be cycled out at the end of the harvest, so they had to go back to Poland. And that really, I think, identified the essence of what guest worker programs have meant around the world in the years that would follow.
So they always mean, come, don't stay.
Exactly.
Come, don't affect us. Come, give us cheap labor and leave.
And that's essentially what they meant in the United States over the years. You take workers in their prime years, 18 to 40. They've been raised elsewhere. They've been educated elsewhere, if they've been educated at all. And you send them back when they're old, right? So it's essentially a development program where the development aid comes our way instead of going back the other way. In 2006, guest workers globally sent home $300 billion. That's three times more than all the foreign aid worldwide. Foreign workers around the world are feeding themselves, feeding their families, providing money for their children's education, but they're also divided from their children. They're divided from their families. Half of those labor migrants around the world are women. So in some ways, we haven't worked out a very good solution to the problem of world poverty when we're telling people, all right, leave your children at home and go work in another country and stay apart from the people of that country, and you can't integrate there, but you can't go home until we're done with you.
What if we didn't have guest workers at all, or illegal immigrants? What would happen to those places that think they need that cheap labor?
Oh, well, we would find it very hard to function, I think, and the most basic services would be extremely expensive. There's an amusing film called A Day Without a Mexican that posits what would happen if all the Mexicans vanished in a poof from the entire state of California. Right now, in Ireland, for example, a sixth of the workforce is made up of foreign workers. In the 1980s, the United Arab Emirates had 90% foreign workers. Half of the Gulf states was made up of foreign workers. This is not a U.S. issue. This is a global issue. And, I think we have to maybe get over the sense of crisis and just accept that foreign workers are going to be a major part of the economy. The question is how best to integrate those people into the life of the polity rather than creating a sort of cross-border caste system.
And where are we right now in the U.S. in terms of coming up with what we want our policy to be regarding guest workers?
There has been a bill called Ag Jobs. It's essentially a compromise bill between growers on the one hand and advocates for farm workers on the other. And it comes with a track toward permanent residency for undocumented farm workers who are the vast majority of the labor force in agriculture. So it basically says, all right, you can get a legal status on a temporary basis. They call it a blue card instead of a green card, and stay in agriculture for 5 years, and then eventually you can get a green card. And then growers would get a deregulated guest worker program because they find the current guest worker program too bureaucratic, and they complain about it bitterly, and they say that it's the reason it's too small, the reason they use undocumented workers instead of guest workers is there's too many rules, too many hoops.
How is America's approach to guest workers different from that in France and Germany, for instance?
The difference is that in the U.S., guest workers from the West Indies and from Mexico came just into agriculture in the post-war period, so into our least well-paid, least unionized industry. And in Europe, in contrast, they went into every kind of industry, into agriculture, but also into metals, into auto, into construction. They went into highly unionized industries. And the unions there pretty quickly figured out that, well, if we can't keep them out, we better make sure that they don't undermine us, so we better get them what we have. And they did. So the conditions tended to go up in Europe, and gradually guest workers got more and more rights. The same, long holidays and sick leave, and they got the right also to bring their families with them. They got the right of family reunification. And when those guest worker programs ended, mostly by the 60s and then by the oil shocks in the early 70s, they tended to stay and to be able to, keep their families with them. There were no deportation programs at the end. While when the U.S. program, Bracero program, ended in 1964, those guest workers were expected to leave.
Why did the oil shocks end those programs in Europe?
Well, the oil shocks battered both the U.S. and the European economies, and there were a lot of jobs lost, and therefore there was less need for guest workers. But those oil shocks meant big business for the oil producing nations. And so you start to see demand for guest workers in those places. And you get just incredible demand for guest workers who come from a lot from South Asia, from India, from Pakistan, also from Korea, who are really kept in isolation in places like United Arab Emirates, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, who are kept in barracks, who are not allowed to mingle with the native population, who have nothing in the way of labor rights. And what's fascinating, I think, is when those economies started to decline somewhat, when the construction started to get scaled back, largely with the first Gulf War, the countries that had been sending those people were now quite dependent on those remittances, and they needed those dollars. So they started marketing their women as domestics. And so you start to see the movement of what was known as the maid trade around the world. We also have students, for example, in the U.S. who come in on cultural exchange visas. And there's somewhat of a racket in this in the United States. We get, for example, in Williamsburg, college students from Eastern Europe and from now Thailand who come in the summer and work at Busch Gardens and work at Pizza Hut and all sorts of restaurants along the main drag, who aren't taking college courses in Williamsburg, but they're on student cultural exchange visas. And they are paying essentially a commission to a recruiter. And then they're sometimes having to work an extra, sometimes two extra jobs in order to make enough money to save anything and take it back with them.
And is this considered a good deal for them?
I think some of them seem quite disappointed that they're not saving as much as they had anticipated and not saving as much to do some of the sightseeing that they had hoped they do. I've talked to quite a number of students who bag groceries at my local grocery store who had hoped to go to Niagara Falls. That seems to be the destination of choice. And when they discover, A, how far it is to Niagara Falls from Williamsburg, Virginia, and how expensive it is to get there, they give up on the idea pretty quickly.
That's really sad, isn't it?
It is. It is. It makes you want to just pack them in your car and drive up to Niagara Falls.
We need a different way.
I think we do. I think we do. I think we certainly need, if employers really need outside labor, we should at least need a non-profit recruitment system instead of for-profit recruiters who are sometimes raking $2 an hour for every $8 that these workers earn.
Well, Cindy Hahamovich, thank you so much for sharing your insights on this with me today and with good reason.
You're welcome. It was fun.